Hi, everyone. This is Lauren Petrovic, founder of Laurenti New York. Welcome to another episode of the Responsible Luxury Podcast. On this show, I sit down with the most extraordinary leaders and people behind driving responsible consumption and production in the luxury goods industry. On this show, we delve into luxury market dynamics, new product strategies, latest technology, and the growing importance of embracing responsible practices in the competitive landscape. Today, I am thrilled to introduce a remarkable woman who really embodies elegance and lives her values in everything that she does. Joining me is Tiffany Stevens, CEO and General Counsel of the Jewelers Vigilance Committee, also known as JVC. As a board director and strategic advisor to luxury companies, Tiffany's expertise is invaluable in navigating the legal complexities of the industry. I think it's very important that we give lawyers the spotlight they deserve because they really work tirelessly behind the scenes, putting out the fires, if you will, and have a unique ability of taking complex ideas and articulating them in a very clear and concise way.
So most folks in our industry are subject to anti-money laundering provisions, right? And you have to have an anti-money laundering program, and then you have to test it about once a year, just in case the IRS comes knocking or your bank asks for it. So all these AML rules that we're subject to, they were all written for banks. So jewelry company, even a big one, is really different from a major financial institution. So they can carry things out and they can do things that we can't. Even our largest businesses aren't that large. So a big part of our responsibility is just showing up for the Treasury Department in this instance and OFAC in these different ways to say, okay, we're under these same rules too. We really want to comply. Here's all the things that we're doing in industry to comply. And how can we make sure that these things get interpreted in a way that keeps our businesses alive and healthy?
In this episode, Tiffany and I explore the evolving U.S. legal landscape, greenwashing, class action lawsuits with Evian, and best practices in high-stakes environments. At JVC, Tiffany and her team operate at the federal level, ensuring regulatory compliance for retailers of all sizes, from mom-and-pop stores to big brands. I like to think of them as guardians for the industry because they are a core pillar and help maintain those important relationships with political appointees and agencies in DC that matter most within the jewelry sector. If you are a part of the industry and have yet to engage with JVC, I encourage you to explore their membership options and reach out to them. Tiffany has an active presence on Instagram, so definitely follow her to keep up with all of her talks at industry events. I am honored to have Tiffany on the show today, providing us with her insights and critical perspective with regard to what's happening now in the jewelry industry. Without further ado, let's dive right into it. Hi, Tiffany. How are you?
Hi, Lauren. I'm great. How are you?
I am good. Really happy to have you on today. Bringing in someone like you with a very pragmatic perspective into the industry and someone with so many years of experience, there's so much I want to ask you about and hear what's going on, especially from a legal perspective.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to start with talking about how you started in your career. So can you take us briefly through how you got started in the jewelry business?
Absolutely. So I've done lots of different things in my career, which I really love. I get a lot of energy out of new challenges and new folks to work with, new industry. So I've been really lucky to be able to shift and change and do lots of different things in my career. And about 7 years ago, just over 7 years ago, I joined the jewelry business. And wow, very lucky. The industry, which, you know, is full of people, multi-generational, people who've been in the business for a long time. But I'm really lucky that the industry has very warmly embraced me. And I really found my people. And don't think I'm going anywhere anytime soon. But it was a huge learning curve to learn, even though I had, you know, a strong legal background, a strong business background, and had been able to adapt to other industries and other environments. Coming into jewelry was, wow, that was like a next level experience because it is so specific and so profound in many ways and so ancient. So it's been just a lot of fun learning all of the different aspects of the trade. And at JVC, I really sit in between, you know, everybody from retailers to wholesalers to lab grown to natural diamonds, colored stones, metals, everybody. So we really get to learn about everything. So it's been a very fun way to put to use all the skills I've sort of gathered in my basket over the years of my career.
I have to say, coming into the jewelry industry, like you said, it has been, it's multi-generational in the space. I think it's very rare to come in with the legal perspective and take a look at the industry, especially, you know, it's an industry that's not highly regulated. There's a lot of under the table deals. So I'm curious, in your work at Jewelers Vigilance Committee, what's something that really drives you and motivates you in the various pursuits and projects at JVC?
You know, our mission is putting ethics into action, and we've been around for 107 years. So that's looked different as the industry has looked different, the country has looked different, our lives have shifted and changed. But I think just constantly interpreting and reinterpreting that mission, just in the 7 years I've been here, we've had some really big headline changes. Everything from lab growns really becoming gem quality and dealing with that through the supply chain to sanctions, which we didn't see that coming, and are still adapting to that. So I think the curiosity and the challenge, my innate curiosity, I guess, and the constant challenge of how this industry, while it's old and multi-generational, it continues to shift and change at a really rapid pace. And the stakes are high because if you get it wrong, I mean, not only is it often a large dollar transaction, but if you're really doing, if you're doing money laundering or something, you need to go to jail. Like, the stakes are high and things change quickly. And that definitely keeps things interesting.
So Jewelers Vigilance Committee is a very longstanding organization. You mentioned the mission of ethics and actions from the founding. Has that always been its core mission?
Yeah, I think that's always been the frame that the organization has looked through since 1917. But it has vastly changed, you know, the different issues from the founding of the KP 20 plus years ago to the issues I mentioned that we've dealt with now, way back when it was a lot more taxation issues. Mm-hmm. So yeah, things have shifted and changed, but we're always thinking about how can we put ethics into action. We're talking to the federal government to figure out how to craft policies that make sense for our industry. And then talking within industry to figure out what's going on the ground. Where can we intervene to help make things more fair? Yeah. And how? How can we resolve disputes? How can we, let's say, coach people who are not doing the right thing? So we're always thinking about that broader purpose, but it comes alive in many, many, many different ways.
And JVC mainly focuses on the jewelers, the retailers, people selling to the end consumer. Is that right?
We do. We have a big focus on retailers, everything from small mom and pop to huge brands. But we also work with everyone. I mean, we work with manufacturers, wholesalers. We work with the gem labs. We work with small designers. Everybody has some kind of ethical issue and some kind of legal issue that is jewelry specific. So we calibrate and talk to a lot of different audiences, which also keeps things extremely interesting. So it's metals, it's stones, it's finished jewelry, it's sort of everything under the hyper-specific jewelry category. We get deep within that specificity.
I would imagine going to DC and talking with a lot of these policymakers, I'm curious what their overall sentiment is with capital and how they feel towards the industry.
Yeah, absolutely. So we reach out to sometimes folks on the state level, or we're in international forums, but really our focus is the federal level and it's the agency level. So we're not lobbying Congress. We're talking to folks working, political appointees and professional folks inside the agencies that matter most to us. And, you know, really a big part of my job has been just building more of those relationships. And certainly people come and go from those jobs. So just keeping those relationships fresh is a really big undertaking for me and the rest of the legal team at JVC. And I think, you know, nobody's out to get us, really. What happens more often than not is that there's overstretched government workers who have a huge portfolio of things they're dealing with, industries they're dealing with. So our job is often to just go in, make sure they understand our unique needs. So I'll use an example. So most folks in our industry are subject to anti-money laundering provisions, right? And you have to have an anti-money laundering program, and then you have to test it about once a year, just in case the IRS comes knocking or your bank asks for it. So all these AML rules that we're subject to, they were all written for banks. So, you know, jewelry company, even a big one, is really different from a major financial institution. So they can carry things out and they can do things that we can't. Even our largest businesses aren't that large. So a big part of our responsibility is just showing up for the Treasury Department in this instance and OFAC in these different ways to say, okay, we're under these same rules too. We really want to comply. Here's all the things that we're doing in industry to comply. Yeah. And how can we make sure that these things get interpreted in a way that keeps our businesses alive and healthy? You know, please don't treat us as if we're HSBC or Bank of America or something, because we're not. That's like one example of just making sure our voice is heard. And at the FTC, which regulates and protects the U.S. consumer for advertising, you know, similarly, we go in and just, you know, jewelry is scientific and specific and hard to understand. And these are super smart people inside the FTC that are dealing with this, but they're dealing with a million other things. So, you know, we go in and we remind them, like, okay, this is the dynamics of our industry right now. This is what's going on with lab grown and natural or whatever the issue is. And just make sure that they have all the information they need to make good decisions, so we're not getting surprised with anything. So I think just constant communication and being really nurturing and proactive with those communications has really, we've seen in the last few years, pay off pretty well.
With some of the challenges arising with the Russian sanctions and the new G7 traceability certification program, I want to ask you from a legal perspective.
Sure.
So one, Russian sanctions, and two, this traceability initiative.
Right, right.
For me, I'm super invested in bringing the traceability fully forward to the consumer, which is still not a full reality yet.
Right.
But do you think that there could be any potential legal regulation supporting businesses? Because once you implement more of the traceability technology, mm-hmm. prices might rise for their products. Would there be any type of tax incentives?
Maybe. Yeah, sure. I mean, this is such an exciting and stressful area right now because it's so alive. Yeah. And I think none of us really know which way it's going to go. I mean, we have the overall edict of Russian sanctions, which I think most people are on board with philosophically, but how to do it, how to enact it is really an art and a science. And we really want to make sure we get it right. So I think there's a lot of anxiety about rushing to a solution that isn't going to actually work, that maybe looks like it works, but doesn't really work, you know? Right. So it's tough too, because this is an area where real technology meets policy. And I'm not a technologist. I'm trying to understand as much as I can about what's possible with the technology. And likewise, the technology people aren't lawyers and policy people. So it's an exciting area, but it's really stressful because, you know, there's a lot at stake and for a lot of people, and we really want to get it right. And then to your question, the after effects of what kind of either incentives or disincentives could be out there once things launch, I don't know. I mean, certainly there's lots of people, as always, thinking about how they can run a business and make money off of this. Yeah. But it does seem like a lot of the traceability options, just from what I've seen so far, there is a profit motive for some people, but there's also just like a kind of everyone huddling around and saying, hey, we need to protect the reputation of our industry.
Yeah.
In our category. So let's think first about the solution and not be competing with each other to have these great little businesses that can solve this. So it really does seem like it's still kind of on this like really big philosophical level. But like I said, I mean, it's so active right now. There's so much arguing. There's so much stress about this. It's anyone's guess about which way it's going to go. I mean, the G7 has been clear that they expect a solution. We have a bit more time in the so-called sunrise period. So hopefully we'll get to something that sort of satisfies everyone by the time we get to the end of this year.
Yeah, I think to your point, it's some type of protocol that benefits everyone in the value chain. The sole focus can't be on profit or dollars. It has to be looking forward in the future, what's going to be best for the next couple decades and the next generation coming.
Yeah, and what's real? You know, if we're saying we can trace it, like we better be able to actually do that.
Yeah. Looking at governance in the EU, for example, and some of their policies regarding more support towards technology, I've had some conversation with folks and we've commented how the US is slightly lagging behind when it comes to regulation support. I know the EU is coming out with digital product passports and supporting some of these initiatives. Mm-hmm. Speaking with DC, how do you think we can address some of the lag?
Yeah, I think that it's a cultural issue that plays out all over the place when we're talking about differences in regulations between the EU and the US, right? Like, they're way ahead of us on food safety. I mean, they're way ahead of us on a bunch of different categories because they have a more regulation-friendly culture in the US. Even though we're serious and market leaders in so many things, we do still have a bit of that sort of Wild West mentality in some ways. And just that even the federal agencies are thinking about, they don't ever want to, what they call chill commercial speech. So they want to protect consumers, but they also want to protect the ability of businesses to flourish. And it's not the same attitude in the EU, for better or for worse. I don't think one is better, one is worse. It's just different. Yeah. And we see that play out in a number of ways, including this one. So I think it seems like we might be coming from a slightly different cultural perspective, but hopefully we can work in harmony and live those same values in a way that's meaningful, because our consumers are so global. We really can't have all these different methodologies with all these borders that really don't exist for jewelry, right? Like, jewelry flows around the world.
Yeah.
It's not going to just stay in the EU if it's made in the EU. Or whatever, like maybe a more perishable item would. But I think that we'll always be dealing with that sort of cultural difference.
I want to highlight the point you said is jewelry is such a global product, global industry. And if we can get more globally aligned on the same policies, you mentioned that the sunrise period of the Russian sanctions we're in now, starting, I believe, March 1st, mm-hmm. coming September is the third phase. What are the updates with the September 1st approaching?
Yeah, the official word, I mean, this is changing like by the minute. So by the time people are hearing this, there might be something different. I just want to footnote that. But those public statements have been that there's an expectation around half a carat, the threshold drops down to half a carat, and that it's contemplated that jewelry would be included and that lab growns would be included possibly. But I think it's all up in the, this is what was announced and what's been talked about, but it seems like things are changing and being negotiated in real time. So it does seem like September 1st remains as some sort of a big next bright line, but exactly what that bright line is, like I said, we've had some announcements, but we'll see as we approach it, like what those actually are going to be. Yeah. But I think most of us are like pushing in the same direction in wanting to, and for the sake of consumer protection, wanting to limit, Russian goods. And it's not that Russian diamonds are bad in any way, shape or form. It's those fresh financial transactions that are benefiting Putin that we're trying to prevent. Nothing about, Russian diamonds is bad. Yeah, it's just any new money that we're sending Putin's way. That's what we're trying to prevent. Not trying to, get rid of Russian diamonds or anything like that, or old Russian diamonds aren't bad or anything. Right. So I think keeping a focus on what it is we're trying to actually accomplish might help go a long way to making us feel a little bit more in harmony as an industry.
Definitely. It's, of course, like you mentioned, things are changing so quickly. There's conversations happening every day. A decision made today, it's going to change in a couple of days. But it also opens up a big opportunity to help change the way business has been done historically in the jewelry industry.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
I think that's another part of the anxiety is people sense that too, right? Or they know that. They go, It's beyond sensing. They know it. This could possibly change a lot, if not everything, for the diamond business. And so there's a lot of, different views and a lot of internal debate going on about how to try to achieve this, because it would be like very groundbreaking if we were actually able to do this.
Yeah. And maybe if we could put many diverse perspectives into it and try to get ahead of the eight ball so that we could be that example leading into the jewelry industry, could be that example leading into the future. And thinking it too of responsible sourcing in the industry, taking a very challenging circumstance such as the sanctions, what opportunities might you see for the future of more sustainability, more responsible sourcing in the industry, and then also to lending a hand to the legal guidance? What do you see there?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think this whole conversation just pulls more focus onto where goods came from, which is like the first question of responsible sourcing, right? So strangely enough, even though we don't think we're talking about responsible sourcing exactly when we're talking about sanctions, we are. And supposedly, right, consumer sentiment continues to build in this direction, especially among younger populations. Yeah. The collective consciousness has just been shifting towards caring more about the impact of consumer behavior and the way we're all connected and how your decision might affect somebody else around the world. So it seems like this is continues to be a growing area of concern. And I personally, and I've said this in other forums, I personally think that jewelry has a good story to tell, especially in relation to fashion, because one of the problems with fashion is the so-called fast fashion and the rate of production. And the end result of the rate of production is the rate of trash and landfills and waste. We don't have that problem. We are not fast fashion. We're the slowest fashion of all. I think we need to take more care and tell more of our good stories about how things come out of the ground for our industry. And that's certainly real. We don't want to avoid that conversation. We want to lean into it and tell the good stories that are happening with everything from metals to colored stones to diamonds. But our products never go back in the ground. No one throws them away. They're not fleeting. They last your lifetime and maybe the lifetime of several other people in your lineage and your family. So I think we have a different story to tell that we should be a little bit more excited about on the sustainability front and not try to just mimic what other folks are doing. And I think another example of that would be recycled gold. So I think our story is not one of recycling because it's sort of inherent in our, in the sort of value and profundity of our products. I think our story is one of responsibility. And so I think we should really emphasize the ways in which our sourcing is responsible rather than trying to kind of mimic recycling or other concepts that are used in other industries. So as you, I'm sure, are well aware, there's really no definition for sustainability for the US market, which is like what's causing a lot of the problems of misunderstanding.
Very convoluted.
Very convoluted because there's no definition. And so I'm sure, as you know, the FTC is right now undertaking a review and a rewrite of the rules that govern environmental claims that anybody can make on any product in the US market. And so the JVC is meant to be, you know, the reason we were founded is to have a voice in these kinds of situations. So we've submitted just about a year ago, actually, our long proposal about what we think should happen. But that was just sort of an opening salvo. We'll get another set of directions and questions from the FTC probably fairly soon, where we can get a little more into the nitty gritty of what we want things to mean. So we're in this time, we're in between worlds on the environmental claims for all products in the US market. And as it stands, there really isn't a lot of hard guidance. I mean, unless you hit the wall of sort of fraud, there aren't a lot of guidance out there right now. So people are just sort of using sustainability willy-nilly. And we see consumer confidence in the word has really plummeted. And our most serious members who are really care about these issues have just sort of stopped using it altogether. And they use other words or they just take more time to tell the story of what responsible sourcing means to them and how they action that in their business.
The overarching topic of greenwashing, you know.
Yeah. So greenwashing, right, is what's happening while we're in between worlds. Greenwashing, of course, is when you're implying or inferring that claiming that your product is more green and environmentally friendly than it actually is. So because of a lack of these hard definitions, people have sort of, who don't really have great intentions, have just sort of tried to grab market share using these terms. And there really hasn't been a price to pay for them other than maybe some consumers who do a bit of research and become disenchanted and turn away. But that's changing in the US market in the last 18 months, I'd say, maybe 2 years. There have been a number of class action lawsuits about greenwashing. I'm not aware of one that's touched jewelry yet, but it's touched many, many other industries. And it's not just what you think. I mean, it's not just people being really flagrant with their green claims and then having nothing behind it. That would be the obvious target for something like this, right? And seems it would be an easy win. And certainly those things are happening. But we're also seeing more nuanced things. So to me, this is really interesting. And this is where, you know, we talked about the gap between the US and the EU regulatory environments. But it's weird because it's sort of like the US legal system with this unique class action system that we have is sort of filling the gap and pushing us closer to the EU standards through this class action system rather than through our regulatory system. Because, for example, one class action that just got certified here in New York State is about Evian water. So, of course, not jewelry, but the situation is that Evian water has a stamp on it, a seal, that they've passed this carbon offset thing that is legitimate. It's a legitimate third-party auditing process. And they were putting the stamp of that on the water bottles. And so that doesn't seem, right? Like in the US, that doesn't seem like it is a big problem. But the court so far has agreed that with the class action lawyer that it's misleading. You can't say that there's carbon offset or that it's carbon neutral to take water from Europe, ship it either by plane or by boat to the US and drink it in the US. Like, obviously that's not carbon neutral by nature of the fact that you've had to ship it. I don't care. You know, they don't care about buying carbon offsets. That's definitely seeming to go out of fashion, which is sort of a different topic. And so they're being sued for saying that this legitimate third party audit that they did and that they passed should meet the needs of the consumer concerned about the environmental impact of the product. This is kind of a huge deal because who saw that coming? I mean, now we're right there with the EU on the way that we're thinking about it. And again, this case hasn't been fully litigated yet, but it's really interesting that it got certified and allowed to go to the next stage. And we see there's a couple other things like that bubbling up in fashion and other product areas where these green claims, like you really... I mean, it used to be something I did a talk like 6 months ago or something that was like from halo to hammer was the name of it. And it's true. It's like people used to kind of try to have this green halo and kind of make some like maybe iffy or maybe like wobbly environmental claims. But now that's going to be a major liability for you. And you really want to be careful about the green claims you're making and make sure that you can substantiate them with data and evidence and that you're not being sort of cute or sly, even if you have the evidence, that it is sincere and forthright, because those are the new standards that are really coming into focus.
I mean, it's a lot. Because I think for big brands, big businesses, making those claims, they have the fiscal resources to invest in these teams to really do a deep look at it. I know JVC also does audits for its members. But for new players coming onto the market, whether they're independent designers or retailers, just specifically to jewelry, they could be completely innocent. But
right,
maybe using
exactly.
greenwashing the wrong way. Like
exactly.
if we're sourcing, you know, if there's a new designer sourcing gemstones in New York and it's all made in New York, but the gold actually comes overseas, the gemstone actually comes overseas.
Right.
Saying that it's made in New York is technically greenwashing. Is that right?
Yeah. And it also actually additionally would violate the Made in the USA standard from the FTC, which they've gotten much more serious about in the last couple of years. But right, it comes from a good place, right? Like you really are trying to make something in New York and you think you did. And then you don't realize that there are these other sort of undercurrents, right? So exactly. And it is an investment of time and effort to make sure that you're doing the right thing. And that is why JVC exists. We don't do like audits per se. RJC has a really great auditing program that they do for businesses, but we do a lot of in-depth guidance and we can help people one-to-one over the phone or with all of our different materials, no matter if you're big or small, kind of understand your responsibilities, what you can and can't say. And then most importantly, right, like how that's changing. Because if you might have been doing the right thing 2 years ago and it's not the right thing anymore, and especially in the digital environment, you have such a limited amount of space to make the disclosures you need to make for our very complicated products, that it's a real art to getting that right.
So from a brand, from a retailer standpoint, the best course of action is to come into the arms of JVC to help understand, you know, you want you to set your business up in a proper standing and make sure you're doing what you're saying. You're backing up what you're saying by what you're doing. And nothing is wrongdoing. But for the consumers out there, you know, how do they know which brands to trust, especially if they're not these longstanding heritage brands, and you meet this, you know, there's a pop-up in New York City, you're visiting this new designer, and they say they're sustainable, and they want to know, like, what questions should they be asking when they go into the stores and whatnot?
So two parts. So first, I just address the first thing that you mentioned, which is not your actual question, which is if you join JVC, we're a membership organization. So when you join JVC, part of that is you apply for membership and we manually assess you. And we look at your digital presence across platforms and some other metrics before we decide whether or not to let you in for membership. And you also sign on to an ethical statement that covers other areas as well. And so we look at everybody's websites and Instagrams as they're trying to join. And if you need to change anything, we'll let you know. So that's a nice first gateway for people and a very hands-on service that we do for our new members. So that's one way to sort of get that health check if you haven't joined JVC yet. But turning to the consumer, I mean, I think that's why the FTC is rewriting the green guides, and we're going to end up having either a definition for sustainability or a ban on using it, which could happen. Maybe a turning away of carbon offsets as a concept. All these things are on the table. Definitely going to have more definitions for recycling. But I think it's really difficult as a consumer right now. I mean, I would be suspicious as if I buy jewelry too, a lot, too much. And I think, you know, if anybody's using a lot of green language, like that's almost like a red flag. Like yeah. If someone's making too many claims about sustainability and doesn't have the sort of requisite balance in how they're presenting this to you, that's probably a reason to not buy from them. Likewise, if someone just doesn't want to have the conversation altogether. So I think the extremes are probably what you want to stay away from. It's it folks who can tell you something about how they source or how their sources, you know, there's so many beneficiation programs in the industry across products. So if a retailer or their supplier is involved in one of those, like I'm involved with Gem Legacy, for example, which is a source for Moyo Gems and Anza Gems in Tanzania and Kenya. But there's a million pilot projects and things out there happening in industry. So I think that's a good way to assess, like, are people really walking the talk? How so? But it is, unfortunately, it's a little bit of a conversation for the consumer. It's not just a easy box to check or an assumption that you can make. And there is a lot of complexity, as you well know, and anyone who's giving you too pat of a reassurance is probably not telling you the whole story.
I think this is also where, too, the technology can really come into the industry and marry beautifully, because
big
you
time.
Tell the provenance of the product, but then also, too, have the product be married to the customer's journey as well to
absolutely.
Really connect with the product. I think
that's
still really early.
So early. But I mean, I think it's groundbreaking. I mean, it's like world shifting, right? Because like you said, I mean, it solves or it at least addresses so many different issues. I mean, even crime, right? Like a lot of jewelry gets stolen and resold. And like the more trackable and traceable this all is, or used in criminal enterprises by drug cartels or criminal cartels, there's so many things that would be solved or at least helped by having a stronger traceability if we can actually do it.
So for members at JVC, what strategies do you guys use for members to help prevent greenwashing once you do this health check?
Yeah,
the website,
we do the health
Instagram.
Check. We give them, you know, the FTC has written a whole 100-plus page guidance about how you can and can't talk about jewelry and advertising. Right. That's separate from the greenwashing and the green guides, but we've kind of married them together in a very easy to understand, accessible publication that's free on our website about understanding how to advertise jewelry. And we wrote it so, I mean, it contains all the substance that you need, but it's meant to be passed along to maybe a junior advertising or marketing, a junior marketing person on your team who's maybe just a couple years out of college. So it's meant to be easily understood for that person who's actually writing that copy. So I'd encourage people to go to jvclegal.org and download that for free. And then we do lots of education and guidance. I'm headed to AGS Conclave in Austin just on Friday. And I'll be talking every day at Conclave about different topics. So we're always out there, members of our team, myself, Sarah Yud, Sally Winters, Alyssa Jenkins Perez as well, like educating the trade on everything they need to know as this changes. So just stay connected to us. We also push out lots of information through our email list if you're a member, and do our best to keep everybody abreast. And then also you can, if you're a member, you can schedule a one-on-one call with myself or one of the other two lawyers to go over any specific questions you have. Like sometimes before people launch an advertising campaign, they'll show it to us, or if they're thinking through a new product idea before they get it approved by the higher ups, we'll take a quick look at it. Because even at big companies who have lawyers on staff, they're more likely to be sort of like employment lawyers or real estate lawyers or corporate transactional lawyers. There aren't a lot of people who know about jewelry law. It's really specific. Yeah. So we find that we can benefit smaller players, certainly, who have no legal support at all, but also even really huge players who have lots of legal support. What we do is so unique that I think we're valuable to a number of different types of people. But I think part of our challenge is just staying super focused on the hyper-specific jewelry issues, because it's easy to try to get pulled in this way and that, right, as problems come up. But just maintaining our focus on everything jewelry specific, I think, has served us well for 107 years and hopefully 107 more.
I think that's fascinating too, because I wanted to ask, do you guys ever see yourself expanding beyond the jewelry trade?
There's enough. I mean, I think we're, you know, Sarah and I think there's so much more we could be doing in jewelry that we're not doing. Like we have a wish list of, we'd love to have a bigger organization and more staff to just tackle what we feel are open issues in jewelry. So no, we haven't thought about what lies beyond, because it seems like there's still so much more to do just within jewelry.
Deeper. It's like, yeah, still layers deeper. You guys have to go.
Yeah. One thing we'd love to do is build a stronger relationship with the copyright office, because the copyright office has not been approving jewelry copyrights and reviewing, and patents are a whole other issue. So anyway, there's a million different things we'd like to do.
I think especially for designers, the IP and trademarks for jewelry brands, I mean, anyone can take a design from anywhere. And
I know, it's so sad what happens. It's almost a march. It's almost like the mark of success. I mean, you know, you're successful when your website is just fully copied and someone's, I mean, it's so depressing. And that's a great example of where we work with other, you know, outside counsel and private practitioners, because we don't do one-on-one kind of granular copyright infringement work. Yeah. We tell people the ABCs and we point them to a lawyer who can help focus on them specifically. The way we play in intellectual property is we as an organization have what's called standing in the legal world to oppose trademarks. So we monitor the trademark register every week. And if anybody out there in the world is trying to register a trademark in the jewelry categories that we feel would be too much of a land grab and that would take away the ability for lots of people to use that word, we will sue, we will challenge that, we will litigate. And we do that. We have one right now that we're working on. Sarah Yud, my colleague, does that work, and she has a 100% success rate. So she's been able to protect the industry at this kind of bigger, broader level. That's kind of how we think about IP. And then we love to refer out, and not refer, but like we help people find the right lawyer for them if they have a specific, you know, IP case that they're dealing with. And likewise, we know a couple people who've been able to patent jewelry designs and functions. Oh, wow. Which is huge, because that's like super hard to get. So there's exciting and depressing stuff happening in IP all the time, but we try to keep our focus on that kind of bigger, broader level.
I said coming into the arms of JVC before, but you guys really are the guardians for the industry.
And it's hard though, right? Because we're out there sort of doing we're sort of preventing a lot of things from happening, which can be a difficult thing to talk about when you're trying to get someone to join and pay a membership fee. It's like, we're doing so much for you. Like you don't have, like you please focus on running a beautiful business, making beautiful and selling beautiful jewelry. Let us worry about all this other stuff that hopefully you'll never even know. The sort of meteor that almost hit the earth, right? Like, so that's our challenge, is communicating that value proposition really clearly and making sure people understand that they are benefiting from us all the time, and that additionally they can reach out and get benefits directly as well. But that, you know, we're doing all of this kind of big work to benefit people now, and then hopefully, you know, the next generation of the business and the consumers as a whole in generations to come.
Yeah. I think it's truly amazing what you guys are doing. I wanted to shift our focus a bit and talk about new innovations or technologies that you're shaping the future of our industry, you know, and that could be from of course, a technology sense, but also too from a design perspective, any new jewelry designs or trends you see
I mean, I'm an artist at heart. I'm a painter. And most of us on staff at JVC have some kind of art practice. Oh, wow. So I'm interested, you know, that's just a way of saying I'm interested in the beauty of jewelry. And, you know, certainly being at all of the different trade shows around the world, it's really fun to be able to get a sense of what's happening and what's changing. I don't know from the technologies. What about you? Maybe I'll kick it back to you. What do you see? What do you think?
You know, I've really invested in seeing how the digital product passports come to play, especially with the large heritage brands like Van Cleef & Arpels and Cartier and Tiffany, and using collectibles, like the collectible market with jewelry. And just, I see, you know, having a digital product passport as a customer, like a digital certificate, you know, you could track and trace, like, maybe when you wore this piece of jewelry at an event or when it was bought and sold, and just seeing that customer story go on beyond the first point of sale, I think is super exciting.
I think it's brilliant. I mean, and it, you know, it's why people like to wear their grandmother's jewelry or whatever, right? Yeah. Because of having on your skin the memory of that. So to have even more documentation and more sort of proof of those beautiful memories and sentiments, I mean, what's not to like, right? And it seems like a major commercial advantage for anyone who's willing to invest in being able to do it the right way. Major commercial advantage.
Yeah. And I think it just, too, again, complements we talked about earlier. The jewelry industry just should focus on telling its story. I mean, it's such a very intricate, very deep, very collaborative process from upstream all the way downstream. And it's
I totally agree. We shouldn't try to simplify it or mimic other industries. Like, we have such a unique position, and it's a beautiful, complex story that we definitely should not shy away from.
Yeah. Thinking too about the traceability and provenance, how do you see the industry tackling this in the next couple years?
Yeah, I'll be honest. I mean, there's a lot of fighting. You know, there's a lot of different points of view. A lot of people have things financially to gain and lose based on how things play out. So I think there's a number of different opinions and approaches. And I really don't know. I mean, we're really in the thick of it. So we'll see how it plays out. I mean, from our seat, we're hoping for the technology to really be the solution. We hope it is. And to get as many people as possible compliant with the right technology. And we want to be, if we can actually trace things and it's real, we want to be able to do that and to move that forward, because it just feels like an important step to modernize the industry and the way that the things are shifting. And, you know, right now we're dealing with Russian sanctions, but there'll be other sanctions, there'll be other conflicts, there'll be other problems and other reasons to know where things came from. So this is definitely not something that's going away. And as you said, like, there's so much digital traceability for so many other kinds of things, from collectibles to heads of lettuce. You know, they can trace, if they can trace heads of lettuce down to the truck, like, certainly we can figure ourselves out. So yeah, I mean, it's exciting, and it seems like it is something we need to make sure we're moving into the future doing and embracing.
Definitely embracing the future is a good value system and perspective. Thinking about the technology, I know for industry, there's Tracer, there's Serene for traceability systems, but what's in consideration now and what's on the table for tracking?
Yeah, there's a few. There's a few more in addition. I think, from our perspective, the concern, we're always trying to see the gaps. So bad actors have always, with our products, so much to gain because they're so small. Our products are so small, so valuable, and so easily transportable. Right. So I think the way that we're looking, you know, as we've gotten to have some demonstrations of some of the different technologies you mentioned and some others. And I guess we're always just trying to think about, okay, if I were like a criminal, how would I get around this? You know? And I think that's kind of the stress test that we're, at least our point of view, you know, the way that we're looking at it. And I think it seems like there's some good solutions out there. I'm still getting my hands around and my head around learning exactly how all of these things work. And I think there's also some other things on the horizon that might be promising, like different ways of thinking about assessing diamonds to lead into traceability and tracking. So I don't know. I mean, unfortunately, I wish I had a technology background, because it feels like you really need both to totally understand this moment. So sorry if it sounds like I'm being evasive. I am, because I don't know which one is right, but I hope one of them is, and I'm committed to learn as much about each of them as I can as we lead up to it, so we can make good recommendations to our members about what to use and, you know, what to tell their consumers. Because you don't want to think in good faith, okay, I'm doing the right thing, and then oops, actually it didn't work.
Yeah, I think too, it's a very cautionary place that we're in. I think everyone is, you know, sitting on the sidelines, kind of watching with the big players, seeing what they're doing.
Yeah.
So it's a very interesting point that we're in now.
But I think another thing to that point, I think another thing that's a little bit worrisome for us, just because of who we deal with, it does seem like some of these bigger players, the European heritage brands specifically, are figuring this out. And they're doing it on a proprietary in-house basis, right? Which is going to give them an even bigger advantage than they already have. So I guess we do feel, you know, some real concern for small and medium-sized enterprises as this technology comes into play, which seems like such a good thing. I mean, I think another way it could really change the industry is forcing out of business some of the smaller players who just don't have the ability to build a technology solution. And unfortunately, that just might be the new reality that we're in. And that's just the gateway now for having a jewelry business, right? Is being able to afford and operate this level of technology. But certainly don't want to see that happen, but it seems like it very well could.
Yeah, there's going to be a big learning curve, big learning shift. But also too, I see what's on the horizon is a peer-to-peer reselling. So I think that's interesting. So from the smaller players,
yeah,
you know, having customers be all a part of this ecosystem when it comes to like buying and trading.
Yeah.
I think that could definitely be a potential coming soon.
That's fascinating. Yeah, that would be very fascinating. And that seems to make all the sense in the world, given the way that we're buying and selling all kinds of things now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Tiffany, so I want to ask, I asked this question, I save it for the end.
For
all my special guests. And the question is, if you could visually depict the industry's ideal state for all to see, what would it say and what would it convey? I always say, if you think of a movie premiere or a big billboard in the middle of Times Square, how would you paint the picture for the industry?
Oh my goodness. I think that we say this a lot inside of industry, but I think it's really easy to forget how loved our products are and how they carry love with them through generations. So we get caught up in our own, you know, petty stuff with each other or worries about the commercial impacts. But our jewelry is so uniquely powerful. It's magic and science. So yeah, it may be some sort of billboard slogan that, you know, you mean so much to us and we mean so much to you, the power and magic of jewelry. I'm not making partner at the advertising firm today with that. But yeah, just, I think it's easy to forget how much we really mean to people. And I take heart in that and just the sheer beauty and the power of love in what we do and the way that lives on. So I think something magnifying and drawing attention to that is our most powerful way to communicate.
Yeah, I love that. I really admire that perspective. I think there's definitely a deep-rooted sense of connection and community in the industry.
Absolutely. And especially if you've been lucky enough to visit source countries and meet our colleagues in the supply chain, you know, the more people I meet in the jewelry industry from around the world doing all different kinds of functions, the more honestly deepened my love is for how connected we really are. And people don't realize they put on a necklace, like how many people from around the world have touched it, and then how much that necklace has touched their lives, and hopefully in a positive way, right? That's what we're aiming for.
Yeah. It's like a weapon for good, you know?
Yeah.
In a way. Well, Tiffany, thank you.
Lauren, thank you so much
for your time.
And, I'm so honored.
I would love to have you on again soon. I wanted to ask if you have any last comments or remarks you wanted to leave with the audience today.
I would say, first of all, thank you so much to you for what you're doing. Thank you for inviting me to be part of this exciting new venture. And if you'd like to learn more about JVC, we're at jvclegal.org on website, LinkedIn, Instagram. And then I have a professional Instagram at Tiffany C. Stevens. I post my talks and activities around the world. Get in touch. Don't be shy. I think we're contemplating launching an international membership program later this year for JVC. So if you're listening to this and you're not in the US, we're finding a way to welcome you on board very soon.
Very exciting. And for our listeners, I will link Tiffany's social links down in the show notes below for you to access her. Tiffany, thank you so much. Good
thank
luck
you, Lauren.
At
thank you.
Your upcoming events later
thank
this
you.
Week.
Thank
and
you.
I hope to see you soon.
Thank you so much. Enjoy
thank
the day.
You.
Yeah.
Bye-bye, you too. I know New York in the spring is
blooming.
One of the best.
It's
bye-bye.
Blooming. Bye.
Thank you so much for listening to Responsible Luxury. If you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. If you have any questions you want answered or ideas to share, please reach out to us at Laurenti New York or connect with me directly. And don't forget to follow at Laurenti New York for the latest updates. I will talk to you soon. See you next week.